welcome to Pete's Percussion Podcast. I'm your host, Pete Zambito, and we're here with the final episode to be released in 2020, Good Riddance. It is episode 222 and part one of my conversation with marching arts designer, percussionist, composer, arranger, engineer, and many, many other abilities, Tony Lyman. Not too much to report on my end. My wife and I, probably like many of you, did not travel to see family for the holiday break. But we have gotten a few occasions to socially distance with local friends and chat with our loved ones over Zoom. For the most part, it's been a fairly relaxing time, and I'll be looking forward to getting back to work with more vigor starting in January. Additionally, since the previous episode posted, the bowl game that Mizzou was supposed to go to in Nashville for December 30th, the day I am recording this, got canceled due to rising COVID rates. Marching Mizzou was not slated to go to this game, even if it had occurred. We were required to stop all in-person classroom activities at Mizzou in November when Boone County, where Mizzou is located, hit a point of rising rates that was deemed too dangerous to continue in person. But it seemed a fitting end to 2020, all things considered. All right, let's get to Tony. Before we started recording this episode, Tony and I were chatting about how we met years and years ago at PASIC. Originally, Tony had me confused with someone else, as he thought we'd possibly met in the early 1990s when he was originally trying to sell his excellent marimba solo of Thoughts and Thinking, a personal favorite of mine that I've played a bunch over the years. It turns out that we had actually met at PASIC in 2002 in Columbus, Ohio, when he was getting back into the percussion game after his time with the band King Conga. This was when he was making his contacts again, and I was working for C. Allen Publications at PASIC, which is the company that publishes the aforementioned marimba piece. And I immediately recognized his name from the piece. But we hadn't talked since then. There are a number of reasons to talk to Tony for this podcast. One, he's been involved in the marching arts for a long time and has so many other interests that we get into during the interview. Two, he was presenting at PASIC 2020 on electronics and the marching arts as part of a panel. And three, his Facebook account is one of my favorites to check in on, particularly as he's waded through the politics and social justice concerns of the past bunch of years with great context, clarity, and positivity. It was for all of those reasons that it was time to chat with him. We ended up going long for this interview, particularly on that last part, and much of that will appear in next week's part two. But for this week, we'll get into his PASIC presentation, current work, his path to this point, and his time with the King Conga Band. So let's get to it. We recorded this interview over Skype on October 25th, 2020, and it begins right now.
You're an East Coast guy, aren't you, originally?
Yes. Yeah, okay. I grew up in New York, but I did all my undergrad and graduate work in North Carolina.
Gotcha.
So, yes. It was UNCG was where I did my master's and doctorate, which is where I met Court, which is how I started working at C. Allen. So,
because you definitely give off the East Coast vibe. I would have put you Boston, New Jersey, New York. I would have put you more New York than anything.
Okay, well, one of those is extremely offensive.
Yeah, the Boston. sorry about the
I'm the assistant, one of the assistant band directors for Marching Mizzou, and we had a sports day this past. We tend to have sports days pretty often, so I of course cannot wear any Jets gear right now because they are a complete disaster.
But
I pulled out my Yankees gear, and then one of our new grad students, I didn't realize either is from Boston, and she wore like a Red Sox gear, and I just looked at her, and I was like, gross.
Yeah.
I can't actually talk to you now that I know this, you know, that kind
of thing. Interview's over. It's always sports that ends my interviews. I did one with Daniel Montoya Jr. and he gravitated towards a sports thing. And of course he's from Texas and he hates the Cowboys. And somehow we got off track on that and interview over.
It's like a toilet circle.
Drain.
So, Tony, tell me what you are presenting on for PASIC 2020.
The clinic's going to be on the use of electronics in the march and percussion world. And our attempt, I'm on a panel of four, and what we're going to try to do is to give four different perspectives of the use of electronics, more for to try to demystify or to give four different perspectives of the use and demystify how to bring those things into your program and use them effectively. I think there will be a little bit of something for everyone involved in the process, because I think we all kind of fit in one of those categories or more. I know a lot of people are one person bands as far as, you know, the designer, the audio engineer, you're teaching it, and you're the band director. And so I think having this information and having these four people speak from those four different perspectives will give a lot of very useful information.
So what is your way in to using electronics?
I got started in recording studios, actually. I toured for 8 years with a band. I mean, all over the country and all over the world. And, you know, we found ourselves in a good amount of recording studios. And then from that, you know, this was the band started in the mid 90s and we kind of ended around the early 2000s. So, I mean, if you keep in a timeline on that, that's when technology became more pro audio technology became more available to consumer on a consumer level, affordable. That's when ADATs became if you remember those dinosaurs, and all of this digital audio and integration with digital audio workstations became quite prevalent during the life of when my band was touring, and I kind of got in on that stuff. And, you know, lo and behold, when I decided to stop touring and get back into the marching game, that stuff was starting to be implemented into the marching band. And so digital sampling and the use of digital audio workstations and the integration of, sound libraries and all of that, there became a parallel of using that in the marching arts. So I was all about it. I kind of found my niche that way.
What were some of the first times that you were at either applications or maybe types of shows that you were starting to apply these, these recording techniques and all that to marching arts?
Well, honestly, the first time I ever did something was around 99, 2000. I had just gotten into, I put away my big score paper and my big eraser and pencil and picked up a notation software called Finale. Mm-hmm. And, I got irritated with hearing wood blocks and parade whistles as marching percussion instruments on my playback. Yeah.
They wouldn't send you the update. I know. Oh yeah.
Yeah. So I was like, you know, I wanted to get some more realistic sounds, and I had dabbled a little bit into digital sampling, and I found this software that I actually, I hate to say it, but, you know, I guess past the statute of limitation. I pirated the software. I don't do that anymore, but I was young and dumb. Called Unity DS1. And it was, digital sampling software that was on my laptop. And I was able to integrate. I remember going in with my drumline and having a couple of techs just play these different hits and stuff. And I created these maps and everything, these key maps, and figured out how Finale could trigger these sounds back. And, I didn't even put any effort into tuning the drums or any of this stuff. It was just, I was more enamored that I was able to get it to actually do these things more. And then I was going to come back. I was like, all right, now I know how to do it. Let's go back and do it for real. Mm-hmm. And one of my colleagues and longtime friend, Ryan Saul, that I worked with here at Pedal High School, he was in Vanguard 99's pit. And so he was a part of the whole alumni association. So he was through the grapevine getting some recordings of Vanguard stuff. And we're listening to these playbacks and I'm like, wow, that's not an actual drumline. I can, like, it sounds very realistic, but I know that that isn't a drumline because of how perfect it sounds. You know, there's no chorused sound of the snare drums. Like, I can tell these are samples and very good samples. So I did some research of like, where is this coming from? And about 6 months to a year later, Jim Casella releases Virtual Drumline. I was like, well, cool. Now I can just buy the stuff and not have to worry about it. But it was only battery samples. After that, I was like, well, I'll just do all the mallet instruments and I could like have my own like virtual pit. Like, let's do that. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, like 6 months, a year later, then the front ensemble sounds came out and I was like, OK. And it was a very arduous task to record every note of every keyboard. And I just, you know, I'm also trying to be a band director at the same time. So thankfully, Jim Casella saved me from that nonsense and he did it properly with Santa Clara Vanguard. So that was my first endeavor with integrating that stuff. And then with I had an indoor percussion group called Eminence. It was an independent open group and started to implement samples and vocal techniques and all that stuff. So I would say right around 2003 is when I started putting it actually into my scores. That was probably more than you wanted to know, but
that's great. It's kind of good to hear that. I was like hearing the timeline. So I'm in favor of that. All the steps. Now, one thing that I think about when I think about electronics usage is particularly with marching band is in a competition setting where, you know, you have the, and I'm curious where you are with this, where you have someone, I've definitely judged some things here and there where you have someone who looks like they're controlling all of the sound for the entire like indoor line. Like they're in a production studio, like they're in a record studio. Mm-hmm. And you sit there thinking, okay, is that guy doing like all the volume and all that stuff? And so, you know, are there points where it's like we can go too far with it?
Absolutely. And I actually did. I was a part of a panel that did a presentation at Midwest. Actually, the last time Midwest happened, basically trying to open the floor for a discussion about the ethical use of this stuff, because there's a point where the students aren't producing the sound. It's more about the designer and the sound engineer than the actual students.
And the students aren't making the musical decisions.
Exactly. And that, you know, especially in, if, you know, just in producing music and education, that is an issue. But to go even further down the road, when you're talking about from a competitive standpoint, then all of a sudden, adults are competing along with students.
Right.
And then there's a point where you have to figure out, well, where is that ethical line? How much is too much? And you know, I don't know if there's a definitive answer to that question. I think it's more of what it is you seek to do. Is this about you or is it about the kids? I think at some point or at all points, you should ask yourself that question.
Yeah.
And the way I try to gauge it for myself is like, okay, what is the most that the students can do on their own feasibly? Like, where's the threshold of, okay, at this point, I'm asking them to do more than what is expected out of the realm of music education. Or, you know, is this a true display of their skills? I think that's another question you should ask. Are you compensating for their lack of skill by doing these things? You know, these are all ethical questions that you need to ask yourself. And I don't think, you know, I mean, we could put together a task force and rules and all these things. But at the end of the day, we're in this for music education. We should police ourselves on these things because we're trying to teach kids how to be better at playing music. And the competition is a facilitator. The electronics is a facilitator. It's another thing. So the way I try to circumvent that or keep myself in check is I try to give the students a skill that they can leave this entire activity or whatever production I'm putting together for them. I want them to be able to leave that with a useful skill when it comes from the on an electronic standpoint. I want them to be able to run main stage. I want them to understand the workflow of a digital audio workstation, how I built all of these things. So when they get out of this, then they could potentially go work, you know, in a recording studio or be creative in this manner on their own using all of these tools. If I just say, hey, stand over here and push these buttons when I point to you, then I've done nothing but teach them by rote and nothing that I couldn't teach any primate to do if I had enough bananas. So from an ethics standpoint, I think it's up to the educator to really police himself or herself to make sure that we're doing these things for the right reason.
How do you see maybe what would be a good either baseline amount of information for someone who's new to it and just is like, what's like the least or something that I can take from this or something that maybe I already have on my computer or in my possession that I can make to good use for, you know, in a marching setting?
I always say you need to start with the sound that you want to produce and work your way backwards because the world, the realm of electronic production is so vast that you can wind up losing yourself in it, you know, and chasing rabbits all over the place. So just like with acoustic music, the first thing you do is I heard the Boston Symphony Orchestra. I want to sound like that, you know. Okay, well, there are many steps to getting there, but at least now you have what you're in. You have the sound that you're trying to achieve. And then you chase that all the way back to a beginner student and how they hold their instrument and how how you educate them from there on. So the same applies for the electronic thing. Go find out who sounds like what you want to sound like. Did you hear it in an indoor percussion group? Was it a DCI group? Was it a really good BOA marching band? and that's, this is all as it relates to the marching arts, of course. And okay, well, you want to sound like that. Well, that person was using a lot of pads in their production. That's what made that lush sound that you liked. Okay. Well, then you go down that path of researching pad libraries and how to implement those things. And usually, what I have found is you find out who the person was that created those things. And I haven't met one person yet in this activity that wasn't overly and abundantly accommodating about helping someone out get into the field of doing this. Especially right now that we've all been kind of furloughed because of the pandemic, you know, there are all kinds of educational opportunities happening right now. People doing Zoom classes, and there are just there's a lot of content being put up on social media along this topic, you know, to the tune of the presentation that I'm a part of with this PASIC presentation. Start with the sound that you want to produce and what you want to make, and then work your way from there.
Tell me about your percussion activities and your other music activities as they are right now.
As they are right now, this has been the strangest year of my entire life. And I don't think I'm unique in saying that.
No.
But right now I am at Pettle High School in Pettle, Mississippi, which is right outside of Hattiesburg, Mississippi, where the University of Southern Mississippi is.
Brett Favre, right?
Yeah, Brett. Yeah, I always have to.
Or John Wooten, you. It's one of the two. I don't know.
Yeah, both. John Wooten is the percussion director at University of Southern Mississippi. And I actually went to Southern Miss when Brett Favre was quarterback there. And I actually know him. We have talked and hung out together, but that was 20 years ago. So, I mean, to say that I know him, it's been 20 years since we've hung out with each other.
Sure. You're not getting Wrangler jeans.
No, the funny thing is last Friday night, he was at the Pettle High School football game doing, NFL Films was doing something, and he was out there, filming something. Anyways, I've been here for the past 22 years. I was a band director from, I started in 1999 here as a drum tech, became a full-time band director in 2004. And about 6 years ago, I reduced my role and became kind of the, marching band program coordinator, and I founded the indoor percussion here back in 2006, and I still serve in that role as the director and show designer for that group. So as far as percussion is concerned, on a teaching level, that's what I do. From a writing and arranging standpoint, I write and arrange for this group, and I write and arrange for a few other bands. I'm kind of transitioning away from that side of things. I have a creative design business where I do, you know, program coordinating, arrangements, set design, and, on another side, I do graphic design and audio design and video and all those things as a part of my creative design business. And as far as playing, I play at a few churches every now and again. And I still have my longstanding gig with a local community theater, which was actually my first paycheck I got playing percussion professionally. When I was 18 years old, playing Annie in the orchestra pit. And I'm still playing with that group. You know, they do three productions every year. And whenever I, the whenever I'm not busy, I definitely try to hang on to that thing because it keeps my mind sharp.
Not that I know Annie super well, but not the most exciting percussion writing, I imagine.
No, but my very first paying gig was the most exciting thing, an unusual turn of events ever, which is part of the reason why I still have the gig. So if I may tell this story.
Yeah, go ahead.
Do you know Sherman Hong? He was a DCI judge for a long time in the late 80s, early 90s. He was the percussion professor here at University of Southern Mississippi before Dr. Wooten was. And he was actually my first percussion teacher. Well, anyways, Dr. Sherman Hong got me this gig. I was a freshman at University of Southern Mississippi. And he played drum set. And I quickly figured out why he hired me, a freshman, to do the rest of the stuff, because I had to haul the timpani down in this orchestra pit and the chimes and the xylophone and all. And, you know, he had his drum set was, you know, like a three piece, like the snare drum, kick and a tom, you know. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it was a great experience. I'm just kind of joking about that. But so I didn't have a car, and he was picking me up to go to the rehearsals every day and go to the gigs. We got into the gig. And on the very last day of the gig, I noticed that it was getting call time, and he hadn't come by my dorm room to pick me up yet. And, you know, it's getting, now it's showtime, and I'm still at my dorm room, and I'm trying to call him on, this is 1990. So there are no cell phones yet that everybody has. So I'm calling his house, no answer. All of a sudden I see his van careening down the street, and his wife is driving it. And so I run down and I was like, what's going on? And she goes, something bad's happened to Sherman. I've got to take him to ER. And I look, and my percussion professor is laid out on the back seat of his van, and there's blood coming out of his mouth, and he has his tux on. And
oh my gosh.
And so she's like, I have to take you to the theater. I'm going to drop you off, and I got to take him to the ER. So she drops me off, and I walk into the theater, and it's a packed house. It's a matinee. It's on Mother's Day, and this is the biggest show of the year. It's 15 minutes past showtime, and I go over to the conductor, and he's like, we're going to have to call the show. And he said, unless you can sight read his drum set book. And I'm like, I guess I can give it a shot. And there are all the, you know how musicals work. There are all of these tempo changes and all the safeties and all of these vamps and stuff and cues out of action. And I was like, if I screw this up, like the whole thing will just stop. You know, like there are critical moments in the show where if I don't get it right, then the thing is just done. And they'll have to reset and it'll just be an embarrassment. But luckily enough, we had done the show three times at this point. And I kind of knew where all these things were going. You know, we're not talking about a Buddy Rich level drum part. You know, it's time and all that stuff. And so about halfway through the first act, I get pretty comfortable with it, to the point where in some of the tacit parts on a drum set, I'm like covering some of my percussion stuff. And so they all saw that as kind of a day saver. I got some extra cash out of it, and I got hired for every gig with this local community theater afterwards. So I said all that to say, I still play with my local community theater.
That is awesome. It's like, it was, you're right. It was not, you were not trying to recreate the Lion King.
No. Yeah. This wasn't Hamilton by any stretch of the imagination, but you know,
It wasn't even Man of La Mancha, which would that
no,
would,
it wasn't. It wasn't.
One of the things you mentioned as you were kind of going through, you know, what you've been doing and kind of your career is this, that you, I guess you took on a lot of stuff and then you were able actually to back to like remove yourself from some of it. Can you yes. tell me a little bit more about what happened?
One of the things about what we do is that we are all opportunists. And I think the, especially the better you are at your craft, I think the more opportunistic you become. And we have been socialized throughout our entire time in this, in what we do, to seize every opportunity that you can, because you never know when you will not have those opportunities. And, you know, the whole early bird gets the worm, all of those things. You know, you can sleep when you're dead, all of the things that we have been, that are kind of baked into our culture. But I think there's a point where that becomes counterintuitive, because I feel like the more you do with this, the more it asks of you.
Yeah.
To the point where you can get upside down in the equation and your health, both physically, mentally, and emotionally, can take a dive. And I was at that point where I didn't know how to say no to things. I didn't feel like I could say no. It was like, first of all, I feel honored that you have asked me to do this. I feel emboldened because I'm able to do it. I've worked to have the skill sets. And then, you know, there's the fear of missing out. What happens if I don't do it and someone else gets it? There's an opportunity that I could have had. And, you know, and then it's like, I don't know when this opportunity will ever come around again. So, yes, I will do it. And that over and over and over and over again until you get kicked out of the end of the equation in a negative. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of where I was. You know, I was doing anything and everything because I could, because it was available. And there's a certain euphoria that comes along with that. It's like, man, you start to equate your own self-worth and value with the number of opportunities that you've collected. But then you got to do the damn things. You got to do them. Like, you've got to actually get in there and do them. And when all of those plates start spinning at once, then all of a sudden that euphoria wears off and you start to meet yourself going. Mm-hmm. And you realize that you don't have time for yourself. You don't have time for your family. You don't have time to look after your own health. It has the potential to send you on a downward spiral. And I was starting to notice around me that was happening. I'm in the age group where, you know, that stuff starts to end, or you start seeing some warning signs of it ending. And I was watching, okay, well, this guy had a heart attack, or this guy, you know, had a stroke, or this guy, you know, whatever, all of these things that were happening around me. I was like, I'm next. And I came up with like a 5-point plan of improvement, where first of all, I had to change my job. I had to change my spirituality. I had to change my mental health, my physical health. And I've gotten through all four of those. I was able to work it out with my school district. You know, I told them everything that I'm telling you right now. I was like, you know, I'm at a point where I want to continue to be here, but I don't think that I'm going to. And it's not because I'm going to leave. I just feel like I'm not going to. There's going to be a day where I'm not going to be healthy enough to be here anymore. So I need to do something about that now. And luckily, I've been here long enough and they valued what I did enough to where I could work something out with the school district, where I could still be involved with the band program and then run my business on the as my primary means of sustaining myself. And mind you, my business that I do now was just all the stuff, extra stuff that I didn't get paid for that I was doing for the band program. And so I got through all four of those things, man. The most recent is my physical health. I've lost 145 pounds in the last 2 years.
Wow.
And
congratulations.
Thank you. And my next one right now is my financial health. That this the last one and probably the most difficult one.
Sure.
Is getting my financial health together. So that was the motivation of me backing off a bit. And by a bit, I mean a lot. And I just had to repurpose myself. I had to repurpose how I went about doing life so that I could still do it to where I wasn't getting kicked out of the end of it.
By means that you don't get to control either, I would assume too, right?
Exactly. Exactly. I found myself with less and less control over my outcomes. Like I had control over the outcomes of the projects that I was working on and the opportunities, but you know, I was driven by those things. Those things were running me and I wasn't running them as it relates to my personal health and you know, ability to sustain myself. Going back to Jim Casella, Jim Casella did a podcast. He was a guest on a podcast where he talked about this very thing, which was the reason why he left the marching activity altogether. You know, he started to look at the diminishing returns, and it really spoke to me. And I remember listening to this when I was, you know, it was like day one in the gym. And I was listening to this podcast and it really settled in for me. So, yeah.
Yeah, this is day one. And yeah. I have like 150 more days.
Yeah. And anybody who's ever tried to change their health, day one is the worst day in the gym ever.
Mm-hmm.
You're out of shape. You're out of breath. It sucks. Everything hurts. And I needed that. I needed that podcast. I needed it bad because it was the motivation that I was doing the right thing, you know?
Yeah. On any of these levels, was there there's one moment where you had this motivation that you didn't even know was coming, but it got you, you know, right when you needed to. Was there another moment where, you know, any of these tracks that you've talked about had like, it was either a turning point or something needs a change ASAP?
Yes. I can tell you the exact one.
Okay.
I had a band parent that, bless her heart, was notorious for taking pictures at rehearsals and marching band contests and stuff.
Bless her heart. I'm sorry, you got me on that. That's I didn't spend it. You know, all my, as you know, I grew up in New York, but I know enough of the South to
yes. That you know what bless your heart means?
Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. All of that. Everything that comes along with that. She would take these candid photos. Like you wouldn't know that she was doing it until you got on social media, got on like Facebook, and there would be like a library of, you know, 50 photos. And there you are like picking your nose or like, you know, when people are taking pictures, you don't know at what point you're in, you know? And if there were 50 pictures, 51 of them were unflattering of whoever they were taking them of. Yeah. And so there was one day she had put some up and I was like, oh, God, let me go through and see what I'm doing here. And I started scrolling through. And about four pictures in, I went, wait a minute. And I went back three pictures and I saw a picture of myself. And I was so large in the picture that I didn't recognize myself. Mm. And it was the moment I said, all right, I got to do something. Like I have a daughter. She's 13 now. And I was like, I've got to be around for her. And I'm looking at this guy in the picture. This guy in the picture is not going to be around a long time. And so I downloaded that picture onto my computer desktop, and I labeled it motivation. And I put it on my desktop so I would have to see it every day. Like I want every day, because I work from my computer like most of us do. Every day that I open up my computer and I work on my computer, I want to be able to see that picture. And that was the defining moment. That's what launched me into changing things.
Whatever it takes, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
It's great. I mean, I'm sorry for you, sad for you for the picture, but I'm glad it was, you could turn it around.
Yeah. You know, most people don't, you know, and I'm just grateful that I was able to, you know.
Yeah. No, that's great. I think about the people that I've talked to, particularly on the show, who, you know, some of them usually a marching involvement where they realize that, okay, I can do, like, I can write for six schools, let's mm-hmm. say, like that, but I cannot do seven.
Right.
Like they know, they have figured out what's their cutoff point. Mm-hmm. And it's like, and it sounds like that's what some of what you had to reorganize for yourself too.
Right. Right. And I'm still like, I still, because what I do is so diversified, that changes. And I still find myself in that trouble of, oh man, this was one too many. Mainly because I don't do just one thing. Like if it were just writing music, then I could go, all right, I'll do six schools and that's it. But when I'm doing, you know, like today I've been editing a music video that I did for an a cappella group. How much time does that take? I don't know. I've never done a music video for an a cappella group, so I can't really budget what that's going to be. So I just kind of, what I've done is I've just kind of set it on a budget mainly, like on a monetary budget. Like this is the amount of money I need to live comfortably. So when I reach this threshold, that's when I know I need to stop. I can't take any more.
Oh, that's great. It's great to figure that out.
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about obviously this has been the strangest, crappiest year. What's been the kind of the COVID situation in the high schools? What's going on locally? How obviously that is, I'm sure, been an unbelievably enormously difficult effect on everything that you do.
I think the biggest challenge of COVID as it relates to what we do is that what we do is predicated upon us making plans for 6 months, a year, 2 years, 3 years, 5 years out. You know, when we're not doing, we're planning. And I can't plan for crap right now.
Right.
You know, I don't know what's going to happen tomorrow.
Yeah.
And, you know, to some degree, I think it's good for us because it takes us back to the roots of what we're doing, which is educating students and affecting their lives and teaching them how to play music. You don't need to know what's going to happen tomorrow to do that. If you know that if you're in a room with a student or with students, you can teach them how to play music. You know, now we convolute that with, you know, we're going to do a concert 3 months from now. We have this competition and that takes many people and a lot of coordination and all this. So we have to make plans and make sure that when we get to doing these things, that they're all well coordinated. But those are all ancillary things and satellites around the nucleus of giving a student care and information about music education in life. When the bell rings and you're there with the student, you don't need plans for that. You don't need to, you know, we have invented all of these things around it. And I'm not saying those things are bad things, but sometimes it's a wag the dog situation where those things become more important, whether we will admit it or not, than the actual teaching, because they require so much, you know, it requires so much energy and so much time, so that when you get to the actual thing that you're planning for, you don't find yourself wasting time or you know, trying to figure out what you're going to do. So it's, you know, half of one thing, 50% of another. So I would say that's the biggest challenge, having to look kids in the eyes and tell them that things that have been important to them all this time, all of the motivators that we've used, you know, I mean, marching band competition isn't everything, but it's been a motivating tool. If you use it properly, it's a motivating tool that parents and students can understand if you do it properly.
Yeah.
And you know, to all of a sudden say that's no more doesn't make you a person that only focuses on competition. It means that your tools that you use, like if you can till a garden with a machine, but you can also use your hands. And the day you have to tell somebody, hey, we're not using the machine that we were more efficient with, you are now using our hands. That's a hard day, you know?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. You know, so that those are the difficult things right now. The lack of a unified approach and a lot of the mitigation that we're doing almost seems like performance art, you know, because there's no consistency even among in the same school or in the same building, you know, it's because we've been, and I don't want to get political on this, because there's just no national response to this thing. Mm-hmm. Literally the heavy lifting of COVID mitigation is on school districts right now. When you're dealing with young people's lives, you're dealing with the truth. And that's, you know, that's the most truth that you can deal with. Here's a person that in 7 years, 8 years needs to go out in the world and be efficacious. And I'm responsible for that directly. That's the truth. And so when I'm dealing with the truth, I've got to do my best. That's the environment that we find ourselves in. And most unusual.
Yes, 100% on all that. I was thinking it's also you can't run from it if it's in your backyard.
Right.
Like schools are, or like the parents of children are, or the teachers, like, or you know, restaurant, you know, all the things that people want open up. It's like you can't put your head in the sand if you're in charge, because
right. A politician can run from it.
Yeah.
When it comes to educators, that's where it ends.
Yeah.
And that is the essence of what educators do. Like, we have trained our entire lives for something like this. Just tell us what it is and we'll take it from there.
Yep.
We know, you know, tell us what it is. We don't even need to know what you expect, because we have a standing expectation. We have a living, breathing expectation. When these students leave our watch, they need to be able to do for themselves. There you go. Get to work.
Yeah. And teachers want to make this effective so badly.
Exactly.
That's what we do.
Exactly. There's no greater monetary or status gain that's going to come out of this. You know, it's not like we're looking, well, you know, if I did it, I'll get this promotion, or, you know, I'll get this sweet, you know, severance package, or I'll get a bonus and I'll be able to go to the Hamptons, or we don't get any of those things. Like, that's not how we think.
Right.
It's like, oh crap, you know, Susie here has a terrible life. I can relate to that. Now, Susie gets dropped off here. If I don't do something, this could be the difference between Susie having a great life or a not so great life. We can't get tired of that. We can't get bored with it because, you know, it's real life and it's the truth, as I stated earlier.
It's Susie coming back in 15 years and saying you made the difference or
exactly
each part. And it's like, it doesn't. Yeah. Like there's nothing financial that is better than that for
exactly.
Sure.
Right. Now it would be awesome if, you know,
if we made a living wage, that's also great.
Exactly. If teachers could be paid like the professionals that they are, that would, you know, I could go down that road for, and that's not the purpose of this call, but I could go down that road forever.
We may save that for a later segment.
Yeah. But those are the hardest things of dealing with the pandemic. But you know, I try to look for the blessings in it. The blessings in it are that we have had to come vis-a-vis with the fact that, you know, this is about relationships with people and, you know, what can you do to make things around you better? And it's go time for that. Like, you have to do that right now. You have to do that. There's nothing else.
Right.
You have to look out for someone. Like, you have to do these things or I could literally endanger someone else's life. So I can't go out in the world and only be looking out for myself because I could literally kill someone.
Right. Great. All right. Tony, let's back up. So you grew up in your town, like in Petal or in?
No, I did not.
Okay.
I grew up in a small town in Mississippi Delta called Greenwood, Mississippi. About 20,000 people. And that's where it all began for me.
Wait, is that near Mississippi Valley State?
Yes.
Okay.
It is. Mississippi Valley State is, it's about 10 minutes from where I grew up.
Okay. So I know the reason I know that is because, when I taught at Lake Union University of Missouri for a few years, HBCU. So we played a football game at Mississippi Valley, and the hotel is in Greenwood.
That you were in my hometown.
All right, nice.
Yes, this is crazy right now. Yeah, and that's nuts. I don't know anybody that has stayed in my hometown.
I don't remember much about that. I mean, we went to the game and went back to the hotel and it was super late. And then the trip was so long that we left at like, you know, midnight or something like that. Yeah. You know, it's one of those.
Yeah. My first memory of knowing about marching percussion started with the Mississippi Valley State University marching band. Those are the first marching percussion sounds that I got in my brain. And that inspired me. I was inspired by the HBCU world. You know, my first percussion teacher was a graduate of Jackson State University.
Nice.
And he put the drumsticks in my hands for the first time when I was 9 years old. So he was from the old NARD school, the National Association of Rudimentary Drummers. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I studied out of the
Pratt.
I studied out of the Pratt book, the Haskell Haar book. I literally started in the old school.
I wonder if because I had been told when you probably know Ricky Burkhead.
Ricky Burkhead was one of my first percussion teachers.
Because I remember I'd had him on a long time ago, and I remember he was telling me that. There was this unbelievable tradition. I think like what you're saying at Mississippi Valley, there's like a specific style that they had. And then there was a break, I think, from like, I guess the 70s into the early 80s. And then there was like a break, and then it, the tradition, I think, picked up, I think, at a different point. Does that sound
right? That all checks out for sure. Yeah.
Okay.
Ricky Burkhead's sister and my cousin were best friends in high school. And so, nice. Yeah, so it was almost like Ricky was family to me. And, nice. You know, he set the example of how it's done, you know, like he bridged the gap between what HBCU was doing and what the drum corps style was, because he would actually come teach my percussion section at Greenwood High School. And so I learned early on how those two styles, what the parallels were of those two styles. And, you know, I didn't know about DCI until my eighth grade year. I was flipping through some channels and got to PBS.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
And it was right in the middle of the Blue Devils 1986 solo, which I think was Paradox. And I had no idea what I was watching, but I knew it was awesome. I thought it was Duke, North Carolina, Duke, like Duke University.
Right. Yeah, of course. Yeah.
That's what I thought. That's the only Blue Devils I knew. And I was like, man, they're showing the band for a long time, you know?
Right.
I've never seen the band on here this long. And, you know, that began my love affair with DCI. And, I watched it every year, and I would make my grandmother watch it and like, come watch this with me. And, you know, I used to tell her all the time, it was like, you're going to see me on this broadcast one day. I'm going to do this. I'm going to do it. And, I had the opportunity to go see my very first live drum corps show in Birmingham in 1990. I had just graduated high school, and I'm sitting there watching, and I think Blue Knights or somebody had just gone off, and I look at the program that says up next Star of Indiana. I was like, I don't want to see this crap. I hated that British show that they did the year before, which is weird because it's like one of my favorite shows now. And I was literally going to go to the concession stand when Star of Indiana was going on, but for some reason I didn't. And I just sat there and I heard the opening strains of Belshazzar's Feast. I turned to the guy next to me. I said, dude, that's where I'm going to be next year. I'm going to be there next year. I don't care what I have to do. I don't care who. I didn't have a car or money. And I'm living South Mississippi, which is 12 hours away from Bloomington, Indiana.
Right.
And I was like, I don't care how it's going to happen, but I'm going to do it. I did it. And I spent 3 years in that drum corps.
Yeah. I have to remember who I talked to about this. They had this just like all-star lineup, right? Was that in that
yes.
zone?
Yes. Well, the next year, 91, which was my first year, we won the world championship. And, you know, we had Hannum and Donnie Van Doren, Jim Prime, George Zingali, Todd Ryan. I mean, it was the Bob Dubinsky. It was the Brent Montgomery. It was the whole thing. Everybody who was on that staff went on to DCI Hall of Fame, and people that I march with have now gone on. I mean, Matt Harloff, Frank Sullivan, Aaron Wells, Colin McNutt. I mean, all of these people involved with that organization at the time went off to, you know, do great things. And then there's me.
Who has also done great things, you know. As you were getting to the point where you could and you know, had the skill and talent to get into Star, you know, what was like kind of the band setting? Was like lessons? How were you kind of developing your skill set?
Well, at that point, I was in my freshman year at University of Southern Mississippi. which was
so before then, but like as you're
in high school,
yeah.
Luckily, in my junior year, we got a new band director who was a percussionist. He was a graduate of University of Tennessee at Martin. He had marched in the old Memphis Blues drum corps. So he knew the thing, and he actually, you know, he's the one that came to me and said, all right, you're as good at snare drum as you need to be. Here's four mallets. This is what timpani do. These are all the things that you need to get into college. Here's the landscape. And, you know, it opened a whole new world for me at that point. I really lost myself into it at that point, to the point where I wasn't practicing much rudimental stuff because I had done that since age 9, you know. Mm-hmm. And I started to see more capital gains in mallets and timpani. And, you know, I started to audition for college and, you know, I went from playing Yellow After the Rain to playing two Mexican dances for marimba, the stout piece, for my audition in college. I was that motivated in getting the things done.
Yeah.
And, you know, when I went to Star of Indiana, I didn't know what I was going to play. I knew I wanted to be in that percussion section. I didn't care what I was going to do. So I went there and I had audition pieces prepared for every single instrument. I started out on snare drum. I was like, well, I wanted to play timpani. Honestly, I really found my love with timpani in high school. But I had a few friends in college that were in the Boston Crusaders. And 1990, and they said, there's this really awesome timpanist from Boston. Her name is Julie Angelis, and she is going to be trying out at Star. And I think she got second or third at DCI individuals that year in 90. I was like, well, I feel confident in my skills, but I just know they're going to pick a vet over, you know, a guy just walking in the door. Sure. So, I was like, and I knew that Star had some issues with their snare line a year before, to where they finished the season with 5 snare drums. I was like, okay, so I know they're going to be openings on the snare line. I feel confident I could go in there and do a snare audition. So I worked up snare drum, and I went in there originally to try out a snare drum. I had a timpani piece that I wrote ready to play. Nice. I had 2 mallet pieces ready to play and a tambourine piece and a concert snare drum piece. And I told Tom Hannum, I was like, I want to be in Star of Indiana. Whatever we need to do, I'm ready to do whatever it is. And, so I was in the snare room and, I was on a drum the whole time. There were probably, I'd say there at that time, probably 50 people trying out for, you know, spots. And I was one of the ones that was on a drum the whole time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, which they outfitted 10 people and they were rotating out, and I stayed on a drum the whole time. So I felt like it was promising, at least, you know, that could have been my, you know, teenage brain thinking. I'm 17 at the time. And, I have on my University of Southern Miss t-shirt, and during the break, the bass tech comes over to me and says, University of Southern Mississippi, you from Hattiesburg? And I was like, yes. And how do you know about Hattiesburg? You know? And, he said, I'm from Hattiesburg. And I was like, tell me anything. and the bass tech was John Corley, who marched bass drum in the cadets all of the years, like 85 to 89. And he was the bass tech for Star of Indiana. And I didn't know that he went to Hattiesburg High School, you know, and moved up to New Jersey to march in cadets, you know, or his dad moved to New Jersey and he wound up being in cadets all of those years. And so we got to talking, you know, we were just talking about the town and everything. And they had just brought in some new timpani. Like they were the crates were bringing them in. And so I'm sitting there looking at him, and he's like, "This is what I really want to play." And he goes, "That's what you want to play?" And I was like, "Yeah." I was like, "Well, I just tried out for snare drum." He goes, "Hang on a second. Well, Chris Lee, who was the brand new pit tech, marched with John at Cadets. He was a Cadets vet as well. He's like, give my boy Tony an audition." He's like, "What do you play?" I was like, "Everything. I got pieces prepared." He's like, "No, you don't." I was like, "Yes, I do." And so he's like, "Well, be in the pit room in 15 minutes. So I go in the room, and Tom Hannum's in there, Bob Dubinsky, Brent Montgomery, and Chris Lee. And I just go through all of this stuff. And they said, "Hey, you're in. We needed somebody like you in the front ensemble. You're in." And that was back, you know, in the 90s. They didn't contract people. Like, you didn't know you were going to be in the drum corps until you were driving away on the bus. You know, that's kind of my whole preparation story of how I got into that group.
So what did you end up playing that first year?
In a front ensemble. Okay. And back then, we moved around to every instrument. Now, I was primarily the timpanist, mm-hmm. which meant that all of the heavy lifting timpani parts I played.
Yep.
But, you know, I also would play marimba for this section of the show, and I played xylophone on this run of the show, and then I'd go and play concert bass drum, you know, for a couple of notes. And that was the landscape of front ensembles during that time. I tell my kids that now, and they, "You mean there was no marimba player?" I was like, "No."
Like, "I don't get it." It's like, "I know." How much did you know about Southern Miss, the university, when you go there?
I had researched it quite a bit before I got. I mean, it was 4 hours from where I grew up. And I, you know, it's one of the premier music schools, I would say, in the country, but definitely in the Southeast. You know, it's a world class music program, and you know, a lot of the professors I would see them in clinics and things like that. So I knew it was the place to go if I were going to stay in the state of Mississippi. I had a few scholarships at a lot of places, but you know, it was more. I got a full ride there. You know, I didn't have to pay to go to school.
Awesome.
So that it was kind of the logical place to go.
Tell me a little bit about the facilities when you were there.
The facilities were not matched by the talent and the size of the program.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that was kind of the case in a lot of places that were in this kind of tier of music school, you know. A lot of great talent. But I remember, you know, we had a front ensemble for the marching band, and it was the concert marimbas that we, you know, that we would do percussion ensemble. I mean, we were just beating the crap up, you know.
Of course, yeah.
There wasn't a lot of equipment, you know, to go around. And we just had to make do. And I wouldn't say there was a shortage or a lack of equipment. It was just that I wouldn't say it was deficient. It just wasn't an abundance, mm-hmm. I guess you could say.
Yeah. But there
were a lot of duct tape moments for sure.
Yeah. Like some wheels needed to be replaced here and there on some malinishments, I'm gonna bet.
Yeah. And you know, Dr. Sherman Hong was kind of, he had been there since the late 70s. And so he was kind of on his way out when I got there. And that's when John Wooten actually auditioned for the gig my sophomore year, my second year there, which the solo Africa Hot was written for that audition.
Mm.
Yeah. And it came from the movie Biloxi Blues. The name of it came from Biloxi Blues when he gets out in Biloxi and he said, it's not just hot, it's Africa hot.
I remember I'd forgotten that line.
Yeah. And that's, you know, that was the solo that he wrote for his audition there. So my junior and senior years, I had John Wooten as my percussion teacher. Professor. God. And from there, like, he really took the studio into the 21st century, you know, as far as starting a steel band program and starting to focus on, you know, more world percussion, getting a drum set tracked started there. Since he did his graduate work at North Texas, he kind of brought that North Texas model to Southern Miss. You know, the studio really grew in the time, you know, when he was young when he got the gig. I think he was 29, I want to say.
Mm-hmm.
He wasn't even 30 yet when he got the gig. So with that, you know, there was a lot of energy that he brought to the studio that wouldn't have necessarily happened under Hong. And that's not knocking Hong at all. It's just, you know, different perspectives, different, you know, it's like the difference in 20-year-old me and late 40-year-old me right now. There are a lot of things that I won't do right now just because I don't have the energy to do.
Right. Was there something when you start studying with Wooten that he picks up on for you and says like, okay, here's something if you work on this.
He got me out of the I'm going to rule the world with my marimba solo. I'm going to go on a solo marimba tour and that's how I'm going to feed my family kind of mm-hmm. thing, you know. Or, you know, if I can just learn the last four bars of this timpani concerto, that's the thing that's going to propel me into world stardom. He got me out of that mentality and got me into a gigging mentality. Like, here are the things where you can gig tomorrow if you have the chops. Like, you need to get in a drum set. You need to learn congas. You need to be thinking in this way. Like, if you play steel pan, you can set a steel pan up next to a pool at a beach resort 99 days out of 100 and make money. And I never really thought in those terms. I never really thought of an applicable use of my skills in reality. You know, I've been fed a steady diet of music school, breathing that air and kind of in that feedback loop of silence, which, you know, I think there's some merit to it. Like, you have to learn the environment, and that environment makes you more serious about what you do. It gives you purpose. But then there's a point where you have to take those skills and then look at the real world and apply them. And if there's one thing that I learned from John Wooten was how to apply those real world skills, how to go get a gig.
Nice. If I'm not mistaken, there are some casinos in Tunica that could use some music here and there, right?
Yeah, yeah. And but the real casinos. Not the real, because those are real casinos in Tunica. But I would say the most prolific casino scene is about 45 minutes from where I am right now on the Mississippi Gulf Coast. And, you know, no shortage of gigs, you know, down there. You can play anywhere. And you know, a lot of big name acts come through town. You know, there was one time Wooten was playing with Regis Philbin and, you know, stuff like Joan Rivers and, you know, and they put those bands together they don't tour with a band. They hire an MD, and the MD contracts out all the music, the musicians, and they show up. They have like an hour gig with the MD. Joan Rivers comes in and sings through the tunes once, and then the gig that night, you know?
Yeah.
I never play with Joan Rivers, but I'm just saying.
Right, yes. That's too bad. I think that would be a good time.
I think I just named two dead people, didn't I?
You did, yeah, because Reed just died earlier this year. It's 2020. Yeah. When you finish undergrad, is this when you go tour?
Yes.
Who's the band, and what's kind of the – tell me a little bit more about that.
I had two roommates that were in the marching band. We were actually in the tenor line. Mm-hmm. And one of the guys wasn't a music major, but he played guitar, like acoustic guitar, and could sing. And he was kind of this ladies' man kind of guy, you know, like – you know, the guy that shows up with a guitar and sings all the songs and all the girls are like, ah, that was him.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And he was one of my roommates. And then my other roommate was a marketing major. He also played drum set in the jazz lab bands there. Mm. But he was like a frat boy. Like he was in this fraternity. And, you know, and then there was me at this point, I'm still like, I'm going to play in the Boston Symphony Orchestra. And that's all there is about that. You know, like I'm still, you know, in the orchestral lit kind of mindset. Mm-hmm. And so his fraternity was like, they did this week long spring party. And there was one night where they didn't have a band. It was like, hey, man, we could put a band together and like get this, you know, do something.
Yeah.
And I was like, dude, I don't do that. Like, I don't play at frat houses. Like, you know, I'm just not of that ilk. It's not me. He's like, oh, we're going to get $250 a piece. I now play in this band. I like what you're talking.
Like, right.
You know, this is the band that I love. This is what I do now. And it was a bunch of, you know, the whole idea was just to like put together a bunch of classic rock covers, mm-hmm. none of which I had heard of before. And I'm like playing percussion. I got, you know, a set of congas that I took from the school, you know, they were the school of music. I didn't own my own congas at the time. And I took a tambourine and duct taped it to a mic stand. And I had a shaker. That was the deal. I was like, dude, I can do this and get $250. I'm doing it. Like,
yeah,
let's have it. So you're, we get there
and you're like, I have to learn songs by a group named Bad Company.
Exactly. You know, and at this point it's a joke to me. Like, yeah. I'm trying to beat the system here is what I'm doing. Like, I'm like, yeah, I'll show them. Like, I'm not going to take this seriously, but I'm still going to get paid. So it was kind of that was my mentality.
Yeah.
So we get there and do this gig, and it was probably one of the most – it was a turning point in my entire musical career. And I know that sounds weird to say, but it was the first time my school of music bubble got popped. Like, the mentality that there's no – integrity in any other music than this stuff that I have been fed a steady diet of. Cause I got there and had a great time. We got paid, everyone enjoyed themselves, and we got another gig out of it. And you know, it just took me out of that mentality. And so that day turned into 2 days, which turned into 2 weeks, which turned into 2 months of getting these gigs. And then there was a booking agent at one of our gigs. And was like, hey, you want to do this on a regular basis? I can book you guys all the time. And I did the math. I was like, wait a minute. We made $250 one night. If I do that for 2 months, that's the most money I've ever made in my entire life, mm-hmm. put together, you know? And, you know, I'm fresh out of drum corps. This is 94. So I'm out of, you know, I'm 1 year this is the first summer where I haven't been on tour. Man, I enjoyed it. From there, we started, the name of the band was King Conga. And the concept of it was, this was post grunge 90s. Yep. When, you know, Hootie and the Blowfish and Dave Matthews Band and Blues Traveler and all these groups started to emerge, this kind of Southern college rock. And that's what we were.
Yeah.
We released albums, started writing original stuff to where we stopped doing covers and we became this original band. We started touring all over the country, wound up, using technology, because this is right around the time this new thing called the internet was becoming a thing. I hopped right on this because we didn't have money for marketing, you know, anything. So here was a tool that we could reach people through computer. And I just hopped on it in the early years. And I learned how to build a website. I bought a book this thick, how to, you know, HTML. And when we were just on the road, I would sit and thumb through this book and learn. I learned HTML. I got a MacBook laptop and got Photoshop on it. And I learned how to use Photoshop to make posters and all. And I learned the marketing game using the internet at that time. Oh, by the way, I forgot to tell you, I didn't finish my last semester of school. Because the gigs got so much, I was like, I'm just going to come back this summer and finish up this summer. Mm-hmm. Well, I didn't come back that summer. It was 8 years to finish my last semester. And we get the record deal. And that's when I realized that this wasn't what I wanted to do. The day after we left New York, I called the guys up and said, hey, I'm done. They were like, what do you mean you're done? It's like, this isn't what I'm supposed to do. I'm supposed to be teaching kids. I'm supposed to go back. I'm supposed to be in Hattiesburg at Petal High School. I'm supposed to go do this. This is what I'm supposed to do. I know this. It was a very tough time because it was very real to me, but we had gotten what we had worked 8 years for. And I realized that it wasn't what I was supposed to be doing. So I left literally the day after, went back to school and finished my degree, and I've been at Petal High School since that day.
Is there a reason why it was like that? Is it because when you know that you're going to be like a recording artist, you know, and that was like, it was like a, hold on, this wasn't my plan. Like what, like, I mean, I'm just thinking mentally, what did you realize in that moment?
It was more that the moment was epiphanous,
okay.
But it was something that had been building over the 8 years. I felt like I was losing who I was. I felt like there were some things about what we did that were deal breakers for who I was. And none of this is like, it wasn't like, you know, drugs or, you know, alcohol or anything. Of course, all of those things are there, but it was more about my philosophical and spiritual well-being and mental well-being. I had a hard time with privacy, even though I'm a very much outgoing person. Like I live for other people. I mm-hmm. get my enjoyment out of watching people be happy. But there's a point where I draw the line and it's me. Like I gotta have myself.
Mm-hmm.
And the further up the ladder we got, the less of that I was able to get. And there were little things that were starting to freak me out. Like the concept of people owning your time. There were times where people would figure out where we were staying at a hotel in X city, and they would just be there. And they would just be there, you know, 2-3 o'clock in the morning, just hanging out because for them, it was how they wound down. This was their escape, and you were a part of their escape. And they wanted you to be that person that they needed you to be for their escape. And I wasn't on board with that. Like, there was something about that that was fundamentally unsettling for me, to the point where when I got home from in between tours and stuff, I wouldn't go anywhere. I would just stay at home. And there was one moment that freaked me out before we had cell phones and stuff. And this doesn't seem like a big deal now, but in the year 2000, it was. Somebody called me up, like, from Michigan or somewhere, like, "Hey, man, is this Tony?" I was like, "Yeah." I was like, "Man, dude, we love your show, blah, blah." I was like, "How'd you get my number?" And he got it from this thing called Google. Like, they Googled, and I was like, "What is Google? How did you get?" And at the time, that was mind-blowing that someone could Google your number or go on a computer and get your number. And I was like, I'll have none of this. And then I got to thinking, you know, like, this only gets worse as you go up the ladder. Like, and I very much wanted to have a family. I was like, what would happen if my daughter or my son or my future kid went to a daycare or something and somebody was there taking a picture? Like, I couldn't handle that. And the concept of all of that is like, I need to stop this before it goes any further. I know this isn't what I'm supposed to be doing. And that was it. And I don't regret it one bit. I did exactly what was the right thing to do. There's no fear of missing out. I never once thought, man, I wonder if it's like, nope, this, I'm doing what I'm supposed to be doing. And it turns out all of that stuff that I was doing for the band, internet, audio, video, graphic design, that all became the stuff that found its way into the marching activity. And that's what I do now.
What ended up happening with the rest of the band after you left?
The deal went away. I think they replaced me with a keyboard player, changed the name of the band, and I think they went on for about 2 months and broke up.
Really?
Yeah. Wow. Yeah, it was – this band was really about the personalities of us four specific people.
Yeah.
It was really infectious the way we would go to a place and just win the place over. Like, mm-hmm. just – we also played at Woodstock 99.
Really?
Yeah, we were on the emerging artist stage.
The Burn It All Down Woodstock.
Yeah, we left right before. In fact, I remember I was backstage with the Chili Peppers when they were doing the whole sock thing. And that was right when we left. Like, that was right. We got out of there because, dude, you could tell it was just in the vibe of the whole thing. Is like something bad's going to happen because there were, you know, 300,000 people out there. It was hot as blazes. Yeah. And, you know, they were charging $8 for a bottle of water. Right. And there was just tension, man. Like, there were some bad people out there. And there was just this tension. And, you know, we played and we were like, all right, that's about enough of this. We need to get out of here while we can. And then that night is when stuff started. We were listening to that, how things are going on the radio, like on our way out of there.
You got out just in time.
Yes.
Yeah. Wow. I had recently watched, I don't know if it was like some segment or some show that did like a whole backstory on that, what happened there.
Yeah.
Like everything you just said. And it was like, I think it was Limp Bizkit's show.
Yeah.
Was the one that like put every, that just sent it. And then the Chili Peppers, I think were like, I think they closed the whole thing.
Yeah.
But it was like, everything was already on fire, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. They were, it was weird, man. It was this, from the artists, it felt like everybody tried to one up each other. With debauchery, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
Oh yeah, you guys did this. Well, we're gonna do this. we're going to do this, you know. And then Limp Bizkit, of course, like, you know, they weren't going to be outdone.
Right.
You know, that place was a powder keg, man.
Yeah.
We'll get to part two with Tony next week. Stay tuned. This week's rave, and this is a shocker, is the 2020 film Soul, directed by Pete Docter and Kemp Powers, and starring the voice talents of Jamie Foxx, Tina Fey, Angela Bassett, Rachel House, Felicia Rashad, and Questlove, among others. Yes, I am actually reviewing a film that was just released, and it is currently streaming on Disney+. The film is rightly being celebrated for being the first Pixar feature film to have an African-American as its central character, a middle school band and jazz professor in Queens, New York, played by Jamie Foxx. The plot focuses on Foxx's character, a jazz pianist who finally seems to get his big performing break, but suddenly, possibly, dies. And what happens to his soul after this event, and who he meets in what can possibly be considered some type of purgatory. One of the main draws to this movie is the way they have incorporated the musical elements involved. Most of the piano playing is done by John Batiste, Stephen Colbert's excellent bandleader for his late-night TV show, and an incredibly accomplished musician and musical force himself. His facility, hard work, and talent at his craft are always completely evident. Aside from Batiste's contributions, the score is being put together by a number of other music industry vets, including, and this is crazy, former Nine Inch Nails frontman Trent Reznor, who has become a well-regarded film score composer in his own right. The film not only conveys specific jazz atmospheres well, but also the many planes of post-life existence it is seeking to showcase. Additionally, I grew more drawn to it after seeing one of the featurettes about the film's Cultural Trust Committee. The filmmakers, who originally were mostly white, took it upon themselves to make the film as culturally correct as possible by having a group of advisors of African Americans who looked into the specifics of the lives as depicted and made sure they were correct, whether that was the jazz club, the mother's clothing business, the barbershop characters, etc. All of that was really well done. There's an enormous amount of layers involved in this film, including the discussions of death and the afterlife, and some nightmare sequences that are probably going to go over the heads of many kids who watch this film. You know, it's also cool as a music teacher to see something somewhat like an actual band teaching experience being depicted on popular film, and also the ways that a teacher can make an impact on a student's life for their lifetime. It's a film that I'm planning to revisit at some point to take it all in and to see if I catch more new elements. But it's well worth your time now to check out Soul, now streaming on Disney+. And that's our show. Subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts and leave a comment and a rating. Please go do that. The show and all of the episodes can always be found at the homepage at petezambito.com/Pete's Percussion Podcast, the episodes. The show is also on SoundCloud, Stitcher, Spotify, and many other podcast locations. If you're on Facebook, like the page Pete's Percussion Podcast, where you can find me there on Instagram and Twitter at Pete Zambito, or by email at petesperkpod@gmail.com. And I will catch you again in 2021 for part two with Tony Lyon. Until then.